Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Welcome to Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host today, Dave Allen. Melody's busy with other client business. For all your gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. By the way, I love that music, the lead-in music to our program. Gets me up and psyched for the show, no matter how dreadful and boring the news may be. And for the next hour, I will be bringing you the news and some opinions and commentary on the economic and political events of the day for Thursday, February 8, 2024. Happy National Giving Hearts Day, everybody. Today celebrates what happens to be the longest running day of charitable giving, so please give what you can to your favorite charity, even if it's just rounding up at your favorite fast food place. It's also National Kite Flying Day, so I encourage you to get out there wherever you live, cavort with nature, and fly a kite, assuming you've got a little bit of wind to help you. What a great way to spend a midwinter day. And last, today is the birthday of the great John Williams, the American composer whose brilliant career has brought us some of cinema's most beloved and award-winning scores. Star Wars, Superman, E.T., the iconic Jaws. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, you know what it is. And Close Encounters, Third Kind, to name a few. Happy 92nd, John. Let's get to today's market report. First, the precious metals. It looks as though gold was really flat today. It was up maybe $4 earlier in the day, closing at $2,034 an ounce. Silver down about a buck, really, 1.75% at $22.64. Platinum down $9, 1%, $898. And palladium down about 0.5%, $5, at $915. Now, U.S. dollar index today up very slightly, 0.08 points, closing at 104.14. In the commodities, other commodities markets. West Texas Intermediate domestic crude oil up, $2.59 today on all the craziness going on in the Middle East, primarily $76.45. Some big bank analysts now seeing domestic oil going over 80 bucks in the next few weeks. International Brent up about the same today, closing at $81.80. Natural gas continues its fall, down another 4+% to close at $1.88 a cubic foot. Treasury market, which we'll be talking more about in the program today. The 10-year yield up 0.05 points. The yield 4.15%. The 2-year yield up 0.034. That's 4.456%. And in the equity markets, Dow Jones up about 49 points. That was up and down by not much all day today, closing at 38,726. The NASDAQ up 37 points, closed at just shy of 15,794. And again, the S&P 500 with a late tease up another just about 3 points, still under that magical 5,000 the market bulls are pointing to, close at $4,998. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. The New York Community Bank Corp, which is a mid-sized New York-based lender, once looked like a big winner in the of the regional banking crisis last year. But now it's in trouble, a lot of it. The bank shares have been plunging over the past week or so, with more than $100 billion of assets. NYCB is big and important enough that its failure, were it to happen, would probably reverberate nationally and possibly even internationally. Their assets, maybe mainly loans, are heavily weighted toward commercial and multifamily real estate. The commercial loans have been hit hard by the failure of New Yorkers to return to the office since the end of the pandemic, while the residential loans have suffered in the wake of a 2019 law that made it much harder for New York City landlords to raise rents. Now, the bank had been diversifying via acquisitions. At the end of 2022, it bought Flagstar Bank, bringing in a broader branch network and deposit base. Then last year, it acquired most of the assets of Signature Bank, one of the three that failed last year, a crypto-heavy lender. Failed the same weekend as Silicon Valley Bank did, although NYCB didn't take on any of the crypto assets. The good news, well, the bank's acquisitions gave it a much broader base of operations and also put most deposits under its Flagstar brand. Surprisingly, the recent decline in NYCB share price hasn't, well, at least yet, resulted in deposit outflows at Flagstar, whose name hasn't been front and center in these stories. The bad news, after the two acquisitions, NYCB found itself over the $100 billion mark for total assets. And that's a level that comes with significantly increased scrutiny from regulators and much stricter capital requirements, particularly if the regulations that are being proposed by the Fed, the FDIC, and the OCC come to fruition this spring. Now, on January 31st, the bank announced that it lost money in the fourth quarter after taking a $552 million provision for credit losses on its commercial real estate portfolio. It also slashed its dividend pretty extensively. And that precipitated a plunge in the share price, as well as the revelation that the bank's chief risk officer and chief audit officer had both been pushed out. Then on Tuesday, that is the other day, Moody's cited high governance risks as it downgraded the bonds of the bank's parent company to junk status. Flagstar Bank, however, retained its investment grade deposit rating. The bank responded yesterday by announcing that Sandra Dinello, the former CEO of Flagstar, who had been serving as non-executive board chair, would take on an executive role alongside CEO Thomas Sangemi. Dinello then took the reins in a call with analysts where he emphasized the strength of NYCB's deposits, plus the bank's underlying profitability and its plan to improve its capital ratios, although that will be required, something it likely wouldn't have done on its own. Now, that turned out to be enough to counteract the force of Moody's downgrade, at least temporarily, and the stock ended up rising modestly by the end of the day. Now, reports say that Dinello did his best on the call with analysts to not sound panicked. But in banking, we know trust is everything. And the markets tend not to trust any bank whose share price has fallen more than 50% in the space of 1 week. I'll have more on banks and their falling share prices in today's third segment. Well, it's a jobless claims Thursday. The number of Americans filing for jobless claims fell last week despite more layoff announcements, especially from high-profile companies. Applications for unemployment benefits fell by 9,000 to 218,000 for the week ending February 3rd. That's according to the Labor Department's latest report out today. The four-week average of claims, which evens out some of that weekly volatility, increased by about 3,750 to 212,250. Now, again, weekly unemployment claims are seen as a proxy or representative for the number of layoffs in a given week, and they've remained at extraordinarily low levels despite efforts by the Fed to cool the economy since March of 2022. Fed's raised its benchmark rate 11 times since then, in an effort to bring down the four-decade high inflation that took hold after an unusually strong economic rebound from the pandemic. Though inflation has eased considerably in the past year, the Labor Department reported late last week that overall prices rose 0.3% from November to December and were up 3.4% from the 12 months a year prior. That's a sign that the Fed's drive to slow inflation to its 2% target is likely to remain a bumpy one. Of course, as the Fed rapidly jacked up rates beginning in 2022, most analysts predicted that the economy would tip into recession. In fact, some thought a deep one. The economy and the job market has remained surprisingly robust. Employers, in fact, delivered a stunning burst of hiring to begin this year, adding 300. This is a reported 353,000 jobs in January, and the latest sign of the economy's continuing ability to shrug off the highest interest rates in two decades. Now, we'll have a better idea of that number when it's revised next month. Last month's job gain, which was roughly twice what economists had been predicting, topped the December gain of 333,000, and that's a figure that had been revised sharply higher. And the nation's headline unemployment rate stayed at 3.7% and has been below 4% for two straight years now, 24 straight months. That's the longest streak since the 1960s. Though layoffs remain at low levels, there's been an uptick in job cuts recently across tech and media. Google parent company Alphabet, plus eBay, TikTok, and the LA Times have all recently announced significant layoffs. And just this week, Snap, which owns the social media app Snapchat, announced it was cutting 10% of its workforce. Now, outside of tech and media, we got UPS, Macy's, and Levi's also recently announcing job cuts. In total, about 1.87 million Americans were collecting jobless benefits during the week that ended January 27th, a decrease of 23,000, excuse me, from the previous week. Well, the good old IRS says it's expecting to take in hundreds of billions of dollars more in overdue and unpaid taxes than previously anticipated. And that's according to a new analysis by them. Now, they say they're not targeting anyone with under $400,000 in income. I guess we'll know that when we see the figures at the end of the year and as time rolls on. But they say tax revenues are expected to rise by as much as $561 billion from this year to 2034. And they say it's all due to stepped up enforcement made possible with money from the Inflation Reduction Act that became law in August 2022. You may recall that in 2022, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that the tens of billions of new IRS funding provided by the act would increase revenues by over $180 billion from 2022 to 2031. The IRS now says that if IRA funding is restored by Congress, and if it's renewed and diversified, estimated revenues could reach as much as $851 billion in the 10 years through 2034. The Biden administration officials are planning to use the report to promote the president's economic agenda as he campaigns for re-election this year and as the IRS continually faces threats to its funding. The Inflation Reduction Act gave the IRS an $80 billion infusion of funds. However, the House, mainly House Republicans, built a $1.4 billion reduction to the IRS into the debt ceiling and budget cuts package passed by Congress last summer. A separate agreement took an additional $20 billion from the IRS over the next 2 years to divert to other non-defense programs, cuts that had been agreed to by many Democrats. Now, since then, the agency has tried to show how it's spending the money it has left in the hopes of stemming further cuts. The customer service improvements rolled out as the tax season began January 29th. That's when the IRS started accepting 2023 tax returns. And earlier this month, the IRS announced that it recouped $500 million in back taxes from rich tax cheaters. Representative Jason Smith, who's the Republican chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, said the report calls for even more IRS funding, uses pie-in-the-sky numbers, and all without being straightforward about where the burdens of massive new enforcement efforts will fall. He said, without showing any evidence, that increased funding will inevitably result in hundreds of thousands of additional audits for taxpayers making less than $75,000. But after the IRA was signed into law, a couple years ago, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen directed IRS leadership not to increase audit rates on people making less than $400K a year. Now, ensuring that people actually pay their taxes is one of the IRS's biggest challenges. We'll see where this all leads. Well, Secretary of State Antony Blinken left the Middle East today with public divisions between the U.S. and Israel, perhaps their worst level since Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza began in October. Some say it's the worst since the State of Israel was created decades ago. Now, wrapping up a four-nation Mideast trip, Blinken's fifth to the region since the conflict erupted. Blinken was returning to Washington after getting a virtual slap in the face from Israel's prime minister. Benjamin Netanyahu told him the war would continue until Israel is completely victorious and appeared to reject outright a response from Hamas to a proposed ceasefire plan that would involve a prisoner exchange. Relations between Israel and the U.S., its main international ally, have been tense for months, but Netanyahu's dismissal has highlighted the divide. Well, that music means it's time for our first break. I sure hope you're going to stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Phone number 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver needs. Physical gold and silver, that is. Check out our website, too, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our weekly newsletters and blogs. That's dgscoins.com. Next time you call Melody or Carla, don't forget to ask us about our new coin special, 50 face value 90% quarters, including a $1 commemorative coin issued to celebrate the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, Korea. The commemorative coin contains 0.77 plus of an ounce of silver, and certainly a steal, this deal at $995, including shipping. Again, ask for Melody or Carla today. Well, the nation's public debt is on track to rise to $54 trillion now over the next decade. That's according to the Congressional Budget Office out yesterday. But raw numbers don't tell you much about whether any given level of debt is burdensome or not. The rubber meets the road test of sustainability is how much of the nation's resources go to service that debt every year, and the news isn't all that good. Federal government is on track to face debt service costs that, starting in 2026, will be a modern record as a share of the economy, and they're forecast to rise from there, pinching other, important national priorities. The government already spends more money servicing the national debt than it does on Medicaid, and the number's on track to surpass defense spending soon, and that's been growing out of sight. Debt service costs were 1.2% of GDP as recently as the mid-2010s and 1.8% in 2019, just before the pandemic began. But the combination of higher interest rates and the swell of debt for pandemic relief spending has pushed that a lot higher. Debt service amounted to 2.4% of the economy last year, double what it did in the mid-2010s. And CBS says it's poised to rise to over 3% this year, 3.9% in 2034. In contrast, the previous record net interest costs for the U.S. government in CBO data that goes back to 1962 was 3.2% in 1991. In dollar terms, net interest is set to cross the $1 trillion mark in 2026 and $1.6 trillion in a decade. CBO Director Phil Swagel says you can think of the increase in net interest payments as two-thirds resulting from higher interest rates and one-third a result of the amount of growing debt. Now, CBO projections are premised on the Fed's policy interest rate moving downward over the coming years, settling below 3% later this decade. They're currently near 5.5% today. The last time the government's interest costs were anything near this level as a share of the economy, in the late 80s and early 90s, deficit reduction became a central political issue and actually a bipartisan cause. In the 1990s, President George H.W. Bush signed a bipartisan deficit reduction deal that, among other things, increased the top income tax rate from 28% to 31%. Then President Bill Clinton's first budget in 1993 raised taxes further, pushing the top rate to 39.6%. Deficits fell sharply through the 90s and flipped into a surplus, actually, in 1998. But politics are a lot different than they were back then, when both parties had many deal-making moderates in among their midst, and fiscal deficits were a front-of-mind political issue. Today, it's less clear how voters and members of Congress who represent them will react to this surge of debt service costs over the next few years. I'm sure a lot of pontificating, not so sure about any meaningful action. Well, speaking of government debt, the Treasury Department sold a record $42 billion of 10-year notes yesterday at a lower than anticipated yield. And that's soothing investor nerves today after a recent rout. And certainly indicating confidence that the Fed will eventually cut interest rates this year. The notes were awarded at 4.09%, compared with the yield of about 4.1% moments before the 1 p.m. New York time bidding deadline. The lower yield indicates stronger demand than traders had anticipated. The auction result also broke a streak of tails, or a weaker result for the previous four monthly sales. Treasuries as a whole held steady as the details were absorbed. The 10-year yield has traded on either side of 4% since mid-December, when Fed Chair Powell indicated interest rate cuts loomed for 2024. The benchmark has neared but never breached the 4.2% level seen when Powell spoke late last year, with expectations for a pivot helping to support the market. Now, Gene Tenuzzo at Columbia Threadneedle said investors see that interest rates are higher than they have been for most of the past decade, and they can lock that in. Well, before the auction, Treasury yields were briefly driven to session lows by the latest bout of weakness in banking shares led by New York Community Bancorp, which we talked about earlier. At the same time, the S&P 500 traded at record high levels, highlighting cross currents in our oh-so-wacky economy. Those were reflected in the Treasury market in the past week, when strong January employment data touched off the biggest two-day sell-off in over a year. And at $42 billion, the 10-year sale eclipsed the $41 billion high-water mark reached last November, well, actually November 2020. with latest changes to Treasury auction sizes announced last week, three of its seven-year notes and bonds, including the 2 and 5 years, scheduled to hit record sizes in the February to April period. The sale was one of three big tests for the market this week. Tuesday's $54 billion auction of three-year notes also drew a lower yield than one that had been predicted by trading at the bidding deadline, another positive sign. The Treasury reportedly will complete its quarterly debt refunding today with the sale of another $25 billion, of 30-year bonds. Zach Griffiths at CreditSight says it looks like a strong takedown all around. Even though Treasury auctions are continuing to rise, demand for duration at these levels remains sturdy, and yields at 4% are historically attractive. And MLIV strategist Cameron Kreis says the takeaway here is that the increased size of the auction did not frighten investors, quite the contrary. Well, this should offer a platform for a nice little rally. Although with a 30-year sale looming tomorrow and CPI revisions on Friday, the scope to really rip is probably limited. Demand for the 10-year sale comes when Treasury investors are grappling with at least two sets of challenges. One, of course, is the uncertain outlook for monetary policy. The Fed has signaled it's likely to cut interest rates sometime this year amid ebbing inflation, but the economy's strong performance is challenging market-implied expectations for when and for how much. And another challenge is the growth in the size of bond markets themselves, including for treasuries. And that refers to the nation's ballooning debt. All else being equal, additional bond supply weighs on a security, but that hasn't necessarily been the case so far this year. And that's a positive sign for investors ahead of the 10-year sale. We shall see. Now here's some crazy news. I wonder what la la land we're living in. Sunday Super Bowl is expected to attract more than 110 million viewers from around the world, one quarter of whom plan to focus more on the ads than on the game itself. In 2022, the average Super Bowl advertiser saw $4.60 for every dollar spent. It's according to the market research firm Kantar. And brands use that digital, creative, and earned media to complement the ads, saw the highest returns. If the goal is to entice viewers and convert them into customers, then it's not enough to place the ad or pop up an event alongside the Super Bowl. That's according to 160/90 President Ed Horn. He says TV ads and on-site experiential opportunities can no longer just live on their own. They need to be married with digital campaigns that will attract and speak to a bigger audience. Plus, digital buzz also generates media interest. And that allows companies to not only sell their products, but also sell their business strategy to newsreaders. That's according to Autodesk Chief Marketing Officer Dara Treseder. Dara says, when you have a big Super Bowl moment, it gives a lot of visibility to your brand. And so it's crucial to have a narrative that can serve as a red thread that weaves through the corporate story during the remainder of the year. Now, Marcus Collins, who's a marketing prof at the University of Michigan, says these monetary returns aren't a given, especially for brands that play it too safe. Collins says mediocrity is the biggest sign of failure. To use the most expensive advertising real estate for a spot that could have been just a regular ad aired at any time. He adds that it's also a mistake to overly rely on celebrity. When the ad becomes known for the celebrity as opposed to whatever brand it's meant to promote, that's a huge miss as well. Well, more eyeballs create more room for criticism, so brand marketers are relying on their communication counterparts to advise on the content of these ads to avoid potential backlash. Collins believes we'll see many value-driven ads this year. He says that people remember the Bud Light debacle and said, I don't want any more of that. Because of it, we should expect to see less of those manifestos about worldviews and ideals. Instead, he says, expect a very humor-driven Super Bowl ad story. That's in line with viewer demands. According to a recent survey from Harris, 69% want to see funny ads. Only 24% want value-driven ads. Viewers are also much more inclined to enjoy ads featuring animals, athletes, or characters from a show or a movie featured in the ad. Only 1 in 5 wants to see ads featuring influencers. Super Bowl ads are the first big campaigns of the first quarter and are a good indicator of communication and marketing budgets, trends, and tactics for the years ahead. Oh, and by the way, the cost of a 30-second ad during this Sunday's football game? A cool $7 million. Another world. Well, not that long ago, the National Football League refused to air a 30-second ad for Las Vegas during the Super Bowl due to gambling concerns. Now, it's actually hosting a Super Bowl there. The NFL's 180 turnabout reflects America's changing attitudes around sports betting, which has spread far beyond Vegas since the Supreme Court's landmark PASPA ruling in 2018. In fact, 6 years ago, Nevada was the only state where you could legally place a bet on the Super Bowl. This year, you can do that in 38 states, plus D.C., and in most cases, you don't have to leave your couch. Let's take a look at the states where you could legally bet on the Super Bowl over the last 6 years. 2018, there's one again, Nevada. 2019, 8. 2020, 14. 2021, 21, including D.C. 2022, 31. 2023, 33, and this year, 39, including D.C. Record $68 million, roughly. U.S. adults are expected to wager over $23 billion on Sunday's game. That's according to the American Gaming Association. It's getting crazy. Nevada's projected to have the largest percentage of the overall betting handle at roughly 13%. Then there's New York at 12.4, New Jersey at 9.6, with Pennsylvania, Illinois, and Ohio not far behind in the 7% range. Just in case you were wondering, as of today, the San Francisco 49ers are a 2.5-point favorite over the Kansas City Chiefs. Crazy, crazy, crazy. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said that he and his NATO counterparts cautioned Hungary yesterday against further delaying Sweden's membership in the military alliance. Lawmakers from the party of Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban boycotted an emergency session of parliament on Monday, where a vote was scheduled to place Sweden's bid to join NATO on the legislative agenda. That's adding to 18 months of delays already that have angered Hungary's allies. The governing Fidesz party, which holds a majority in Hungary's parliament, has stalled Sweden's bid since July 2022. They've been alleging that Swedish politicians have told blatant lies about the state of Hungarian democracy, and the party's insisting that Sweden's prime minister must come to Hungary first. I guess to kiss the ring of Viktor. Sweden, along with neighboring Finland, set aside decades of military neutrality to seek protection under NATO's collective security umbrella after Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2 years ago. Finland has since joined the transatlantic alliance, and all 31 NATO members now must agree that Sweden can join their ranks. Hungary is the only member right now standing in their way. Sullivan said he wouldn't stand here today and make particular threats or speculation about steps that we could take down the road. But of course, our patience on this can't be unlimited either. Well, we're hitting that point in time where we're going to step away for a few minutes. Please stick around, listen to these important messages. We'll be back. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. This is the voice of your host today, Dave Allen. We're at 1-800-375-4188. And online at dgscoins.com. Let's start this final segment with some continuing news from abroad. Russia's electoral authorities have barred war critic Boris Nadezhdin from running in next month's presidential election there, saying that he had submitted too many defective signatures in support of his bid. Oh, brother. Politicians who wish to run in Russian elections must turn in at least 100,000 signatures or more, or more in the case of independent candidates in support of their platform. Nadezhdin, a former Russian lawmaker and well-known political pundit in Russia, submitted nearly 105,000 signatures last week to Russia's Central Election Commission, which oversees national elections. And that commission, there's the CEC, said today that he is ineligible to run because of the high percentage of defects in the voter signatures he collected. The CEC claims that more than 15% of the signatures didn't qualify, but, of course, didn't present any evidence to back up its decision. A working group of the CEC had indicated that a significant number of signatures were defective, and Nadezhdin's group had signaled that they would appeal the ruling. Asked about the decision, Kremlin Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov said electoral rules were being followed. Kremlin had already sought to limit Nadezhdin's potential to upset an election in which a win for incumbent President Vladimir Putin is seen as really a fait accompli. Peskov said last week that we are not inclined to exaggerate the level of support for Mr. The decision to bar his candidacy will come as no surprise to close watchers of Russian politics and Kremlin critics. Political analysts said it was extremely unlikely that a political candidate standing on a liberal anti-war platform who has garnered a following among a metropolitan section of Russian voters would be allowed to run in the election. They added that the Kremlin likely feared a potential swell of support for Nadezhdin that it would then have to suppress, as it had done with other political opponents like, yes, Alexei Navalny. Still, analysts have been keen to point out that Nadezhdin is part of a Russia so-called old school of politician. A former lawmaker who's been associated over the years with several parties who have backed Putin. Nadezhdin, they note, was still counted as a member of the systemic opposition that exists in Russia to at least present an appearance of a political plurality. They point to Russia's Communist Party, Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, and a Just Russia, being part of the systemic opposition that rarely dissents from the Kremlin line on major issues like the war. Nadezhdin was standing as a candidate on behalf of the Civic Initiative political party under a campaign manifesto that had promoted peace with Ukraine and a friendly cooperative relationship with the rest, the West, as well as fair elections, and notably a smaller state. The party, which has not been banned, was co-founded by Ksenia Sobchak, a Russian media personality and a dabbler in political affairs, and others. Sobchak has at times been promoted as part of Russia's opposition movement, but she's been long suspected of being a Kremlin stooge, especially given her family links to Putin, rumored, in fact, to be his goddaughter. Can't let Ukraine fall, ladies and gentlemen. Bloomberg's Joe Wiesenthal notes today how stocks rallied again yesterday, with the S&P 500 now close to the 5% gain on the year. He adds, it's interesting how we see this strength despite rising interest rates and the Fed downplaying the prospect of an imminent interest rate cut. Still, while officials keep waving off the prospect of a March cut, Wiesenthal says it's worth noting that even the more hawkish members are still talking about cuts, just not right away, and maybe not as deep as the more dovish members. Here's a great roundup of Fed speak since last week's decision to hold rates steady. First, from their chair, Jerome Powell, it's unlikely the Fed will reach the level of confidence to cut in March. The prudent thing to do is to just give it some time and see that the data continue to confirm that inflation is moving down to 2% in a sustainable way. Austin Goolsbee, the Chicago Fed, says if we just keep getting more data like what we've gotten, I believe that we should well be on the path to normalization. And Cleveland Fed's Loretta Mester, if the economy evolves as expected, I think we will gain that confidence later this year, and then we can begin moving rates down. Of course, Neil Kashkari, the Minnesota Fed, who I believe yesterday or the other day, said, we're not looking for better inflation data, inflation data. We're just looking for additional inflation data. Would like to see a few more months of data. Adriana Kugler, the newest Fed governor, said she's optimistic that inflation progress will continue. At some point, the continued cooling of inflation and labor markets may make it appropriate to cut rates. Susan Collins of the Boston Fed, seeing sustained broadening signs of progress should provide the necessary confidence I would need to cut rates, step likely later this year. Patrick Harker of the Philadelphia Fed says, with inflation falling, employment remaining strong, and consumer sentiment looking up, a soft landing is in sight. And last but not least, Thomas Barkin of the Richmond Fed, who says, I am very supportive of being patient to get to where we need to get. Now, of course, in the meantime, people have been talking about how the economic data is looking surprisingly robust. Last week's strong non-farm payrolls report's a major example. But of course, we also know about the rise in consumer sentiment, some decent ISM data, and the general commentary from corporate America and others. So at least for now, Wiesenthal says, we seem to be in a period of strong data and an expectation of cuts at some point, though not right away. There are two ways he believes that could happen. One is if some Fed officials start to question the wisdom of cutting at all. I cannot see that happening. But he says if we get more economic heat or obviously an inflation pickup, then maybe the appetite to lower rates diminishes. Well, that could in the shorter run. Or the recent economic strength could prove to be a bit of a mirage. Even in that strong NFP number last week, there were some sources of concern, such as the shortened work week and the softness in the household survey. NFPs, the non-farm payrolls, the jobs report. If the data were to surprise to the downside in the coming weeks and months, then Wiesenthal surmises that the cuts, but not too soon message could be overly hawkish and in fact risky. But at least for the moment, it seems like a nice spot for investors when the data generally keeps beating expectations and mostly Fed officials are talking about not if, but when they're going to start cutting rates. Fascinating new paper claims that Donald Trump's trade war with China didn't help the economies of rural America. It did, however, make him more popular in those places. The interesting findings suggest that the politics of China tariffs is much better than the economics of them. There was no direct employment boost from the policies in 2018 and 19, for example, but the move still rebounded to Trump's political benefit in areas most impacted by the tariffs, namely the Midwest and parts of the South. It's a recipe, they say, for further trade tensions between the globe's top economic superpowers should Trump retake office next January. And it does come as Trump barrels toward winning the Republican nomination, seeking a return to the White House while threatening to jack up tariffs on China a lot further if reelected. This new paper from David Autor, Ann Beck, David Dorn, and Gordon Hansen builds on their previous work that showed just how damaging the China shock in the 90s and 2000s was for local economies exposed to trade with China. The paper finds that tariffs imposed on Chinese imports had no material employment impact in the period covered by the paper, that is through December 2019. But the study's authors find that retaliatory measures imposed by China had a consistent and significant negative employment impact in these regions that was only slightly offset by the aid sent to farmers, again, largely the Midwest. Those measures reduced employment in crop production, transportation, and warehousing, among other sectors. But they add that although the goal of bringing back jobs to the heartland remained elusive, voters in regions that had borne the economic brunt of Chinese import competition in the 90s and 2000s were particularly likely to reward the Trump government for its tariff policies. The results of the study suggest Trump would have a political rationale to continue aggressive trade policies. That's according to one of the authors, Dorn, an econ professor at the University of Zurich. He said, if it's the case that tough tariff policies are sufficiently popular with the voter base, the government might really be tempted to make use of that measure, even if it's not a good economic policy. Well, last weekend, Trump confirmed previous reporting that said he would impose at least 60% tariffs on Chinese imports. Maybe he said it's going to be more than that. His words, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, not mine. And finally today. Yes, as we spoke a couple of times today, the S&P 500 closed at a record just 5 points shy of 5,000 yesterday, moved up 3 more points today. At the same time, banks of all sizes, big, medium, and small, continued to see their share prices getting hammered. And while the media is focusing on the 56% share price collapse of New York Community Bancorp, that collapse has been just this year to date, several other banks are trading at their lowest levels in 2 years. Pam and Russ Martin in today's Wall Street on Parade highlight that U.S. Bancorp, parent of too big to fail U.S. Bank, which is the fifth largest bank in the U.S. with $663+ billion in assets of as of December 31st. They point out that the FDIC indicates that U.S. Bank operates in 28 states with over 2,300 branches. Their common stock, that is of the parent, has lost over 30% of its market value in the past 2 years. Then the Martins point to KeyBank, the 22nd largest bank in the U.S. as of September 30th last year, with $186 billion in assets. The FDIC shows KeyBank operated in 16 states with just shy of 1,000 branches. Now, the common stock of its parent company, KeyCorp, has lost 50% of its value over the past 2 years. And Comerica, the nation's 32nd largest bank with $86 billion in assets as of the third quarter last year, operates in six states with 415 branches, mainly Michigan, California, and Texas. Their stock has lost 50% of its market value in the last 2 years as well. And Western Alliance Bancorp, parent of Western Alliance Bank, the 35th largest bank in the U.S., as of the third quarter, with $70+ billion in assets. It operates in six states with 38 branches, mainly Arizona, California, and Nevada. Its common stock price was battered during the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank last March. And over the past 2 years, its shares have lost 45% of market value. Point out that smaller regional banks have experienced even more dramatic pain. They point to First Foundation, for example. They've seen their share price lose 70% of market value in 2 years. And certainly the too big to fails haven't been untouched either. Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and Deutsche Bank all down between 20 and 30% over the same 2 year time span. In fact, Deutsche Bank closed down another close to 5% yesterday. Indeed, the Martins remind us that the global behemoth Credit Suisse blew up during the regional banking crisis last spring when it was taken over by UBS. You live in interesting time, ladies and gentlemen. Make sure that your savings are insured with plenty of gold and silver. That's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody back tomorrow with Butch to close out the week. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly blog and your email inboxes in the AM. Thanks always to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good night. Bye-bye. I have a plan. If I got you.